Hello and welcome to another episode of the Dan Assor Show, supported by show community patrons, TF Connect, Tarsus Group, 19 Group, SISO and Smart Digital. This week I spoke with Greg Hitchin, CEO of Terrapin, a world-leading global events company which organises events in the Americas, Europe, Asia, Africa, Australasia and the Middle East across a number of industry sectors including education, energy, finance, health, management, retail, technology, telecoms, and transport. Check out all of my content on danassor.com and be notified first about new episodes by subscribing to my YouTube channel and by following me on Apple Podcasts and Spotify platforms.
Hello and welcome, Greg. Delighted that you could join us on the show today. How are you?
I'm great, and thanks for the privilege of being here, Dan. It's I'm looking forward to it.
The privilege, I'm sure, is all mine. It's always great to have guests like yourself give up their time. So, Greg, I always start off with on my podcasts, for those that are listening that might not be aware of either yourself or the business, obviously you're the CEO of Terrapin. Can you just start off for me just sort of explaining a bit about the business? Bring it to life. Thank you.
We've been going since 1987. We started as a publishing company in Sydney, Australia. The company was founded by our still executive chairman, Tony Steele. We got into events as a kind of a side business, but events became the main game. At one point, we were owned by Euromoney Publications, PLC. But then the company was bought back from Euromoney. This is an interesting fact that people may or may not be aware of. In 1995, we produced about 1,200 conferences around the world and about 1,000 training seminars. At that point, we were probably the second biggest producer of conferences in the world. But we eschewed that model, and we are now quite a different sort of business. We have 9 businesses across 5 geo profit centers. We have revenue of about $80 million. We employ 320 people, and we run about 100 events. So we've gone from producing, 1,200 events to 100 events. It's a completely different ball game to the game that we played in 1995.
Sure. Thank you. And actually, maybe we'll get into that and the sort of decisions that you took around that sort of adjustment. Yeah. But before we do that, before we get into some of the other topics that we're going to discuss, talk to me about your background, Greg, because I detect a slight accent, so possibly you weren't born.
Yes, I come from Western Australia.
Yeah,
and I probably shouldn't really be sitting here. I mean, I've been with Terrapin since for almost 32 years, but when I applied to work at Terrapin's predecessor. They rejected me, but because the person they employed didn't work out, and because it was near Christmas time, they couldn't be bothered to kind of re-advertise it as we did in those days. So they called me back, and I joined as a conference producer. And 34 years later, I'm still here, and it's been a trip from Sydney through Singapore, Hong Kong, Africa, South America, New York, London, Middle East. I've worked on the ground in all those places, either directly producing events or having a very significant role in them.
It's interesting. So I speak to lots of people that have, been with their businesses for many years, whether they found them or they started off with a business and continued. And then sort of the other end of the spectrum, you read about, I guess, this generation, shall I say, who sort of chop and change roles quite a lot, right? You know, they want to see what they're into, and you know, they're not necessarily sticking around, but you've stuck at it. Give me a sense of why that happened for you, and what you know, if you're giving advice to younger people now, what's your view on that?
I joined this business when I was 32 years of age, and I had a terrible CV. I'd played in rock bands and managed bands and promoted some gigs and stuff like that. And so my CV was shocking. And but I was always interested in business and economics.
Sure.
And I guess having been in that sort of a kind of show business environment, I was I was able to connect the two things and find something that I really like doing. And I guess the thing is, I saw events as being an incredible opportunity, and as it was then, it is now. It's a it's a great career, and you know, I look at some friends of mine who, you know, had perhaps more kind of traditional traditional jobs, and you know, maybe they're lawyers or bankers or something, but I think I've had a lot more fun and have had a much more richer career than they have. And and the thing is about events, whichever bit you're in, it's extremely dynamic. And with the sort of stuff that we do, you know, there are always challenges every single day of the week. Amazing. Sure.
So it's constantly evolving. And I guess, you know, no 2 days are the same, which means it's not for everybody, right? Because some people, as you say, like the, you know, sort of expectation and of it being this similar experience. Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of the best event people are really right-brained and left-brained. You know, they're able to be organized and be creative, because it does take the spectrum of qualities to, you know, to be good at events, for sure.
Sure. And you describe yourself as a passionate event creator.
Yeah.
So, and we've touched upon a few of the reasons why that you might say that about yourself, but what drives this passion, and I guess continued passion, to have done it for so long?
I just find events, you know, really intrinsically satisfying, and it's, you know, it's something you can do without, you know, being alienated from work, you know, to sort of, you know, to sort of get into a bit of Karl Marx. But being events, you're connected. I mean, and that's good. And you can do all sorts of things, but you can create stuff.
Yeah.
It's so damned entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
I mean, events come from the air.
Yeah.
It suited my interests and my personality or my character. I mean, I've always read a lot.
Yeah. And
I remember Richard Copley Smith. Do you know Richard Copley Smith?
I don't. Tell me who he is.
Well, he was, he's dead now, but he's the self-proclaimed godfather of the British events industry, British exhibition industry. Yeah. And I saw him once at an AEO conference, and he's asking himself rhetorical questions. So, Richard, where do you get those ideas? And Richard answers, I get them from reading. Oh, Richard, what do you read? I read everything. So, I mean, I don't read everything, but I read a lot. And that's, I mean, some of the best things that we've ever done is have come from, you know, reading an article in the Economist or the Financial Times or the the Far Eastern Economic Review as it was, and creating an event. And you think, wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, keeping your eye on
it. Some of those events can last for years and years and years and years.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Thank you. So I want to talk about what you think makes a good event. Now, obviously, there are lots of different facets that go into an event.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've been to hundreds, if not, well, thousands, I guess, events over the years.
Yeah.
Whether you've organized them or whether you've just attended as a delegate. So let's start about some of those components. So start where you wish, whether it's content, whether it's exhibition stands. Just give me a flavor of what you think makes it.
If we can go back to high school algebra and to Venn diagrams.
Oh, if we have to.
Well, I mean, just four circles, four Venn diagram circles.
Okay. I started to come out in a cold sweat here. Yeah.
No, you don't need to do that. It's all right. Please calm yourself down. It's all right. So one circle I'd say is ideas and knowledge.
Yep.
That's important in an event. Another Venn circle is networking. Another Venn circle is showcasing. Another Venn circle is having fun. So the intersection of these things, it creates a sweet spot, like in a tennis racket. And, you know, if you have all those things, you've got a really good event. And events, really good B2B events need all those things. You know, they probably need some more, but they need these things as the fundamentals. Ideas and knowledge, networking, showcase and fun.
Yeah.
And that's, I've seen it like that for a long time. You know, maybe all of our events are not like that, but they certainly aspire to that.
Yeah, it makes sense. Thank you for, I guess, simplifying it, because it doesn't have to be rocket science, does it? It's just understanding, you know, human needs and emotions.
Yeah.
And the psychology of events sort of fascinates me as well as to why people will attend and what they want to do when they get there.
All those sort of dimensions, but
sure,
you know, people love having parties, people love meeting, people love learning, people love selling. I mean, you know, the last 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, I've been to a lot of events, Terrapin events, lots of other people's events, and I visit Excel regularly, as I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And what really gets me is, even in this sort of, in these straitened times, the vibrance of these events is incredible. People getting together to do business.
Yeah.
You know, to have great peer interactions, to have fun, to learn. It's extraordinary, this energy around events. Even when in a time when things are kind of crap. It's amazing the vibrance of this industry.
Sure. Talk to me about serving communities, because obviously Terrapin are quite laser focused.
Excuse me.
Okay. It's okay. Talk to me about serving communities, because Terrapin are quite laser focused on specific sectors, right? So talk to me about the power of community and how an event can serve that community, and also how you serve that community all year round, I guess, with different tools.
Well, I think, I mean, the event is the ultimate manifestation of the community service, if you want to define it like that. And as we've just discussed, how do we interact with the communities? I think that's something that we are working on, and we are working on it by, and this is not new, by various online publishing means, and of course, using platforms like Swapcard to augment the physical sure. Event.
And that's definitely been one, I think, positive outcome out of the pandemic, is that we've learned more to engage with the communities all year round. I just want to talk about, I've done a lot of trade show sales in my time and ran sales teams. And, you know, you think you've had a good show and then the exhibitor comes back and says, oh, it was all right. You know, it wasn't great. And then you think, well, actually, it's not surprising, because when I stopped by your stand, you know, the setup wasn't great, or the team on the stand weren't sort of engaged or motivated to do what they meant to do there. I've read articles, and we've spoken about this before we came online, from you about, I guess, the responsibility of the exhibitor in this process. You know, we can only, as organisers, take, I guess, the horse to water. What do you think exhibitors can do better to try and get a better positive return on their investment at an exhibition?
Well, it goes back to how they plan their participation, and is this part of a greater marketing strategy? But you know, from the planning, I guess it comes down to the attitude of, am I going to really make this successful? Do I need it to be successful? Can I be bothered? And then onto the stand where, I mean, it is surprising that people don't dress their stand properly, whether it's big or small, and then they kind of hide away. Yeah. Especially smaller exhibitors. Bigger companies, of course, they're much more on it. However, sure. I mean, something I've observed recently, and I wrote a little note about this on LinkedIn, is that I can't remember the well. Many large exhibition stands are fortified. They've got all these obstacles to prevent people from coming on the stand, and you know, some of them are extreme. They're fully curtained, and they've got one entrance, or they're a dark room, or they've got so much furniture that you know it doesn't invite people on. They don't invite people onto the stand. I think that's a mentality issue from exhibitors, from designers, and from organizers. I mean, the thing is, the fundamental thing about going to a show is, you need to maximize the contact that you have with prospective and existing customers, for sure.
Do you think the organizer, exhibitor, and the other suppliers that are sort of working with the exhibitor can collaborate more closely to try and affect what you've just said in a more positive way? Because I sort of, again, in my experience, sort of got the impression that, and not everyone does this, you know, you sell the stand and the exhibitor goes off and speaks to the designer, the creative types that use the budget in the best way they think is possible, but not necessarily thinking about the whole event. So do you think as organizers, we should be more collaborative?
Oh, I think that really is the golden ticket, isn't it? I mean, if we could, I mean, we all talk about it a lot.
No.
But
then we tend to move on to the next thing.
We move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
I know some of the big agencies and the big contracting firms are trying to promote greater collaboration, but it doesn't always happen.
Terrapin operate, as you mentioned at the beginning, in different parts of the world. Now, you know, they're a local, even though the world is a smaller place, to coin a phrase. Correct me if I'm wrong, there's still, you know, cultural nuances and different ways of operating. Can you sort of bring those to life a bit? Some of the challenges, you know, operating in different parts of the world, you know, UK compared to Middle East compared to Asia?
Well, in terms of what people or markets want to do. I mean, I actually think there's an business to business, I think the commonalities actually far outweigh the differences. Business people are always interested in innovation, technology, finance and investment, supply chain, sustainability. Whether they are in Sydney, Abu Dhabi, or Johannesburg, or New York, they're more or less interested in in the same things. And I think it's I think that makes it good for organizers. And that's how many organizers have been able to, you know, pick up their product in one place and put it in another. Of course, there are, you know, nuances and you know, different sorts of norms, but you know, of course, it's different in the Middle East to working in Britain, and of course there are various regulations that one must comply with in various different places, and there are various pitfalls. I mean, we've all I think if you've been around for a while, you've probably got the scars on your back.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the interesting markets really is the United States of America.
Yeah.
This is something I think many foreign organizers, they misunderstand this place, and they misunderstand it at their great cost. I mean, we've been trying to work there for 20-something years, and I don't think we haven't cracked it, but we keep trying. I mean, and one of the things is the United States, this wonderful, incredible place, is not really one country. It's it's kind of 50 different countries, and you know, you've got to really understand that, you know, in a big sense, and then down to the doing, you know, things like marketing and visitor marketing. You know, you can't just say, oh, I'm going to market this to the United States. No way.
No, I guess one of the keys is to have partners on the ground that obviously understand the community. Yeah. I mean, outside of the exhibition industry, you all know history is littered with companies in whatever service or product they've got trying to go to the States and miserably failing. And actually, it's the same even with, you know, entertainment, you know, celebrities, rock star, you know, that doesn't always translate. So that you're right. It's interesting because the USA.
But sometimes it does.
Yeah, of course. Sometimes
it does. Especially if you were the Beatles.
Indeed. And actually, I was listening to a radio show yesterday who were talking about sort of pre, I guess, TV and celebrity status. Charles Dickens was one of the only sort of people also to cross over. The early sort of opportunists to do that. So it actually can happen. But what I'm saying is it's interesting because you would think, oh, it's the same language, can't be that difficult. And we've spoken about that you can more easily geoclone an event into even sort of Germany, different language, than you could in the US. So you're not the first person to say that to me. And it is interesting. I see lots of smaller companies, funnily enough, trying to start to launch in the US as opposed to Europe. I guess we'll see how they get on with it.
I mean, the prize is there. I mean, it's the best events market in the world. If you view it as a, you know, one country,
and
when people crack it there, they really crack it.
Yeah. I want to move on to some of the future challenges of the industry. And obviously there are lots of macro issues, which I don't, you know, we can touch upon briefly, like, you know, obviously the global economy, deglobalization, the war in Ukraine and so on. But one that you've mentioned to me, and I know that's sort of close to your heart, is sustainability.
Yeah.
So talk to me about the current challenge that the industry, and I guess B2B trade shows specifically, face around sustainability, and then let's maybe talk about some of the possible solutions.
Well, trade shows, events, have a very, very big travel component in them. And that is undeniable. And it falls into the bucket of any travel-oriented industry. And this is the big thing. You know, I think it's relatively easy to make progress and relatively easy to make progress on lots of other things. It's the travel thing. However, I mean, the best argument I heard about trade shows and events and sustainable travel is I first heard from Charles McCurdy from Informa, who said the thing about trade shows is that it brings buyers and sellers together at one place.
Sure.
So vendors don't have to go on, you know, 100 or 50 trips. They can just make one. I think that is a pretty decent argument for, well, especially for, you know, industry defining events, for sure.
Yeah.
Our own journey, we've set off on a journey and we want to be carbon neutral by 2030. We're working with an organization called ISLA, ISLA.
Yeah.
And we are working on all of our events and all of our business. And we will progress. We will be progressing to that target, and hopefully we get there by 2030. And we're already doing what we can.
Sure. And does that include, I guess, looking at the supply chain to your events?
Oh, definitely.
You're sort of challenging them as well, because I guess that's what... Well,
absolutely.
Yeah.
We are challenging them as we ourselves are being challenged. Sure. I mean, some of our big customers are saying to us, what's your sustainability policy?
Sure.
And I think... For all event organizers, if they don't have one, I think they're going to be in a bit of trouble.
Yeah, but they need one, not just as a tick box exercise, I guess. You know, they need.
Well, they need a policy, and they need to be doing it. They need a roadmap, and are actually doing something.
Sure. Obviously, we're in tricky waters from an economic perspective. Just briefly, over the next sort of 12 months, again, speaking specifically about your shows and the industry we operate in, how do you think that's going to play out in terms of, you know, exhibitor investment into B2B events, delegate attendance? I know we don't have a crystal ball, but what are you seeing at the moment?
Well, at the moment... At 2022, we are doing at least as well as we did in 2019, which was our best year.
Sure.
That's in terms of both revenue and in terms of attendance at our shows. And some of our shows, I mean, I know it's the same with everyone.
Sure.
Some of our shows are going through the roof. I think it depends on the sectors you're in. Now, we're in some good sectors, and especially some sectors that are kind of recession proof, like life sciences, and solar energy, things like that, that are just, you know, going gangbusters. But we have vulnerability from tech. We have a lot of tech things running through almost all we do.
Yeah.
But with all that said, we are in the position now where most of our shows are pretty well respected and are right up there in terms of, you know, being important to the communities they serve.
So with that in mind, just finally on this point, do you think it's going to be hard for people, whether they're independents or organizations like yourself to launch new shows in the current environment?
I think one can always launch. I think one needs to be circumspect about what it is. I mean, and of course, all of us are gonna get some of our shows bashed up going forward. And some of those shows might survive, but the thing is we can always find new shows to do. And I think the thing is, in an economic downturn, you know, you can't really focus on things that you can't control. You know, you can't focus on what the government or the Bank of England will or won't do. You can just focus on what's within your control. And you know, maybe that means it might mean trimming the portfolio. It might mean, deploying resources where they, you know, to events that are really hot.
Sure. Just in the final part, just want to talk about Greg as an individual. You describe yourself as, to start off with, you describe yourself as a mobility enthusiast. What do you mean by that?
My passion project is this event series we launched a couple of years ago called Move, which is about the transformation of urban mobility. I just find it incredibly intrinsically interesting and dynamic, which objectively it is, but also I like that sustainability edge, you know, and things that, I mean, real change is required, and it's good to be involved in something that maybe helps change a few things around.
Sure. So do you agree, coming back to sustainability as well, that it's a combination of the legislation, but also, you know, people getting together and actually doing stuff themselves?
I think, you know, incentives are always good, but... Yeah. The power of business, the power of technology, the power of creativity, it's there. These are the things that will change the world.
Sure. And I know you post quite a few articles about Elon Musk as well, who's heavily in the news today, taken over Twitter. Do those people sort of inspire, might be the wrong word, but do you sort of understand, you know, do you understand what those people are trying to do is change the world, even if they don't go about it always the right way, whatever that means.
I don't think I'm that inspired by high, you know, really high level people, except perhaps Bill Gates. So I think his philanthropic works are incredible, but also the way he thinks. You know, his book about was it called Preparing for the Next Pandemic or whatever it's called. I mean, this is a very important book, and almost everyone should read it, because another pandemic is coming.
You think? Yeah,
there will be other pandemics. The most important thing is that we are much better prepared for it than we were when COVID struck.
Sure.
And that book by Gates is just an incredible read. And it's a sort of a warning.
Just finally, last couple of questions. What advice would you give to Greg Hitchin at 18 years old if you were to look back?
Oh,
knowing what you know now.
Go for it. Go early. And also perhaps the one thing I've learned in my life is that it's attitude is everything.
Yeah.
If you want to be successful, you will. If you don't want to be successful, you won't be successful. You know, and you know, I've worked with a lot of people over the years, and the thing that defines successful people is this positive attitude for success.
Sure.
So perfect. Just have a really positive attitude.
Excellent. Greg, thank you so much for your time. It's been fascinating. I'm sure we could have spoken on many other topics. So I'd love to have you back at another time. We wish you personally and Terrapin ever more success in the future.
Thanks, Dan. And I really appreciate your podcasts and also your contribution through your various charitable endeavours.
Cool. Thank you.